keep on the sunny side of life. It will help us every day, it will brighten all our way, if we keep on the sunny side of life.
Welcome to the second Export Finance podcast. We have here today Simon Sayer, Simon Jones and Gabby Buck. Welcome everyone. I don't know about you guys, but since the first podcast, our office has been just inundated with fan mail. I was at the Exim conference recently, just asked to sign body parts and all sorts. It's pretty riotous. The topic today is a one very close to a lot of people's heart, which is the subject of regulation and advocacy within export finance. So I'm going to kick off with the first question. Is the export finance industry doing enough collaboratively to communicate with different regulators on the treatment the business gets? Anyone able to take that on first?
Simon, you're the oldest.
Which one?
Simon.
That must be Simon Jones.
Yeah, it is Simon Jones, but you can start.
Well, okay, so I thought very carefully about this, and I actually think the industry is doing enough. I think there's been a huge amount of activity in communicating with the regulators. I know from the discussions I have with our internal teams that there's no let up in the consultation process with, for example, the BAL Commission and the BIS. The collaborative approaches, and this was your word, collaborative, is there enough a collaborative effort, are the most effective. There's no doubt about that. Going through trade associations, through banking bodies, corporate associations, the EBF, the BAF, the ICC, is without doubt one of the most effective ways of doing it, because the issues are slightly different for each individual bank. And when they're communicated to the market, the message consequently gets a little bit distorted. So the collaborative effort through the associations is the most effective way of doing it. It's been voluble, it's been consistent. I think the one area where I would say things could be improved is that I think the efforts to date have been quite regional. And by that, I mean there's a sort of a European lobby, there's an American lobby, there's an Asian lobby, although perhaps a little bit behind the other two. And I think there could be more of an internationally coordinated effort around this. And the ICC, for example, has been one of the bodies that's noticed that and tried to bring a more global approach to the story. But I think it's going actually pretty well.
I'm glad to hear you say that,
because I haven't been as part, being in Asia for the last 5-6 years. I haven't been as big a part as these guys in London have been, or Europe have been, because you say the Asian side maybe a little bit behind. So I had assumed probably I had seen what's going on. I've been invited to a few sessions with the ICC, etc. So I agree with Simon, it's the only way to go. Individual corporate pressure is going to fall on deaf ears, largely irrelevant. So I think the collaborative institutional views. And I think banks are also taking some measures, some defensive measures as well. So the banks are doing whatever they're doing through the bodies, like the ICC, and the Bern Union or whoever. And then I think banks, because regulation is getting tighter and tighter, I think banks have their own internal defensive mechanisms to what will happen if we don't succeed through the bodies, if we don't get there, what if? And I think there are other things the banks are doing, like developing investor bases for their asset class, just in case they can't lend. Mm-hmm. As well.
Mm. Just taking this on before we get to Gabby, but when you say ICC, to clarify, you mean the ICC Banking Commission. Obviously, it's sort of, this is banking focus. There's BAFT, there's the EBF, the EBA, the British Bankers Association. And one of the things that came out of, some of the papers I've seen is certainly, kind of earlier in the process, is that maybe there was a need to get more corporates involved and actually some real industry voice into, how this is impacting different companies. So in terms of that industry collaboration, do you think there's enough to bring corporates into it? Are you seeing corporates actually being able to voice that as well? Or is it very much a banking effort so far?
My view on that is it is very much a banking effort so far, and I think this is the challenge that we as banks are not experts in regulation around the passenger car auto industry, and wouldn't be able to sit in front of VW and tell them everything that's going on in terms of the regulatory environment for their cars. Ditto, getting that message across from what's happening in the banking market to our corporate clients is very, very challenging, particularly when it comes across from individual institutions in a different way. So I think that that hasn't happened as effectively as it might yet. I'm sure it will. There's a time element here as well, that the new regulations will have to stand a test of time, and if they don't, they'll have to be changed. But to answer your question, I think that's less effective. It has come primarily so far through the banking institutions.
Okay. And Gabby, do you have any comments on the collaborative question?
I do agree with Simon Sayer in regard to the international coordination that's going on between, you know, the various interested stakeholders on regulation when looking at export finance. But I do believe, though, we're playing catch-up. I think that the regulation was imposed onto the banking market as a whole. There's been unintended consequences as a result of that, which has not had a knock-on effect in terms of export finance and trade, which I think has... You know, I think the whole industry, from a banking perspective, I think was caught off guard. And you know, what we are now seeing is a rear guard action to try and address some of those problems that are impacting industry as a whole. So I think when looking at are we being proactive about this, you know, I don't think we've been really that strong. You know, I think if you look even in the most recent of regulations like Article 194.1 in terms of risk transfers on export credit, bailing clause has come in. I think both of those came out of the blue. So I think there's a lot more that needs to be done in terms of having an ongoing proactive dialogue with regulators. But the challenge with that is twofold. One is that the regulators are really not really focusing on trade. So, you know, the regulation that's coming in is trying to cover other aspects. And secondly, the volumes that trade does in comparison to other asset class is so small that it's very difficult to get the regulators focusing on this as a specific asset class.
But you have to look at what regulation was set up to do. I took the liberty of Googling it yesterday just to get a, okay, what is it? And I got a definition here. It's not the only definition, obviously, but financial regulation subjects financial institutions to certain requirements, restrictions and guidelines aiming to maintain the integrity of the financial system. Now, that is one hell of a big topic. As Gabby said, we are such a small part of it. Why would we gain their focus on day one? They're not aiming at how do we regulate trade finance. They're aiming at regulating and ensuring the sanctity of the financial system.
It's a bit, I mean, if you look at the Big Short, you know, it's all about... Great film.
Yeah.
But, you know, what is it that went wrong in 07, 08, right? It was the CDOs, it was the subprime. It wasn't AAA US Exim assets.
No.
Right? So I think, so the regulators are focusing on trying to stop behaviour of what happened then and wanting to ensure that the banks are much more disciplined in the type of businesses and assets that it's booked. But that one regulation covers everything.
Yeah. I don't think we're... This is a big surprise. I mean, the financial crisis happened. Regulation would have probably increased anyway, but the financial crisis happened. Regulation had to change. Mm. It's a big picture topic, a massive area covering a multitude of types of banking and banking products. And the fact that there are unintended consequences, as Gabby said, which is one of the favourite phrases being used... by the groups that we're working with, is no surprise, because they weren't aiming at... They were aiming at a bigger picture solution, and they had to do a hell of a lot very, very quickly. So I think it's just now a process of getting working through those unintended consequences.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. I have to say when you mentioned the Big Short, though, you know, just to kind of go off piste a little bit. But one of the things that did come out of that film is that you had sort of sectors. Obviously, it wasn't the export finance sector, but you had sectors that had a kind of over familiarity and over reliance on each other. Sort of, you know, everyone knew everyone else. You know, and could some of those same things be argued to be the case in various areas of trade finance, of export finance, of syndicated loans?
That's a really interesting question. I mean, I remember when I first joined the export finance market.
Careful.
I know. I was advised or told, look, you know, export credit agency, you'll never lose any money. And I said, never say never. I remember that same phrase was said to me about 5 or 6 years earlier when I worked in the property team, right? When in those days, property was deemed to be gilt edge, you never lose any money. So so there is always risks. And I think, you know, on your point, Dan, I think there is an acceptance, particularly pre-2007, 2008, that any export credit, any sovereign, any export credit agency guarantee would never go under. And you know, the perception that there are different counterparty risks associated with different sovereigns and different export credit agencies is really only just started to come in the last 6-7 years, which is interesting given that the export credit agencies have been around for, you know, 90 odd years, as we were talking about the last time. Mm. So I think there is an element of being over familiar. There's been too much comfort. There's been too much reliance on what has happened in the past.
Export credit agencies have been dragged into the regulatory environment. I agree with that. If you think back, it was intuitive more with export credit banks going back 15, 20 years that the deal was covered by US Exim. It's covered by US Exim. I think there's no, I don't think there's any concern there. I still think it is. But the regulatory environment meant the banks had to go through a more rigid framework in order to assess it and come to the same conclusion.
Now, my point, though, Simon, was that pre-2007, I think all of the banks priced all of the export credit agencies in much the same way. There wasn't a differentiation in pricing for different counterparty.
There was less differentiation than there should have been.
Correct.
Yes.
And that, I think, is the big change.
But that came through competition, I think, and aggressiveness and an over-liquid market.
And it also came about because of a real change in the underlying credit of those individual ECAs. The world was a benign place pre-crisis.
Yeah. Yeah.
Post-crisis, it was a very fragmented, fractured place with real differences between different countries, different ECAs, pricing environments, ratings, and everything that goes with that. So I think that was a kind of a natural development.
Yeah. I can remember Romania being able to raise five-year money at 30 basis points over LIBOR at one stage in that benign 2003-2004 period when people were saying, oh, they're coming to the EU, so everything's okay. Greece, the same. Greece went from 5% per annum to 22 basis points per annum for a five-year deal, you know, in a very short space of time. It didn't stack up, really.
Yeah.
So getting sort of back onto the regulatory issue, would you say, difficult question, certainly for some in the room, but would you say that regulators are, you know, given what you've said about that they've got a big job, a big task, and obviously global trade is only part of that, do you think they understand or are getting an understanding of this business?
I have to say yes. I think they do. I would say the regulators understand very well the issues that are at stake. I think for them to understand every single aspect of every single narrow niche area of banking is just asking too much.
Yeah.
And that would probably be true for our industry as it is for many others. And coming back to what we were saying earlier, they had some very big problems to fix. Very big problems to fix. They had to ensure there was no longer any systemic risk in the market. They had to safeguard the soundness of banks. They had to protect investors as well. And most importantly, they needed to do those three things at any cost. It couldn't go wrong. It had to be achieved.
And very quickly.
And very, very quickly. So, you know, inevitably, there were going to be some things that didn't quite fit, would have some unintended consequences. Which weren't going to completely work at the first go. And I think the regulators completely get that. They had an imperative to fix things. They'd have done incredibly well in doing that. And now the detail starts to get worked out. So my answer to that question is, yes, I think they do get that. The consultation levels, as I was saying earlier, are very intense. In fact, they're intensifying rather than petering out. It's getting more and more consultation. And that's a good thing. The detail will get worked out.
Yeah, I think that... And the same thing happened under Basel II, I think. I seem to remember that there were some unintended consequences there, and there was discussion, and things did get amended prior to full implementation of Basel II. There aren't probably as many... There weren't as many then as there are possibly now. And also, as we discussed on the last podcast, you know, there's volatility at the moment. There's recession in many, many countries. There's a bleak outlook for the world economy. The voice will have to be listened to, because we are financing the real economies. And if we're not listened to, that's going to create additional risk in the market if trade, whether it's short-term trade or long-term trade for infrastructure, is impacted. Mm. It'll have consequences.
Mm. So Gabby, do you think that export finance has been fairly treated in this process?
I don't think export finance was looked at when the regulations were being put into place, for exactly the same reasons Simon's just pointed out. You know, they were trying to fix other issues. I do remember, post 2008, when, we were looking at, we collectively, a number of banks were going into the Bank of England trying to get UK export finance assets classified as high quality liquid assets. And the question that came back was, who is UK export finance? I don't think they understood what was going on.
They had bigger fish to fry.
Exactly, and I think that's the issue. You know, they had the problem that they had was massive. Yeah. And export and trade finance, didn't hit on the radar.
It's not a question of fairness. I mean, I think you used the word fairness in the question. It's actually not a question of fairness. It's bigger than that.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at the main impact of regulation, the leverage ratio, the match funding, the liquidity buffer, all of those aspects are there to safeguard a bank and the shareholders and the stakeholders generally about high risk assets, not about high quality assets. And so therefore the regulation is looking at something else, and it's having an adverse impact to this business.
But for very good reasons. I mean,
don't get me wrong.
After Basel II, it changed a little bit. Yeah. Liquidity was one of the fundamental problems that occurred.
But I don't agree with you, Simon, regarding... that the impact is having an adverse effect to clients, because I think what's happening
is,
well, you just said that it's that the real economy is struggling in terms of.
No, I said it would impact the real economy. Okay. I don't think it's coming yet. It could impact the real economy.
I don't think that's going to happen, because I think what's happening is that the real economy is getting its liquidity from other forms of financing, and so therefore, from a client's perspective, they don't give a monkeys as to where the funding is coming from.
Yeah, no, that wasn't quite what I agree with you. So the market will evolve because of this.
Exactly.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah,
I think two of the most fascinating things about what's happening in the current environment is that two of the single largest issues facing the export finance industry at the moment, which are coming out of the regulatory environment, and what are they? Leverage ratio, Gabby just said it, first of all. Second, the whole environment around KYC and anti-money laundering regulations, what you have to do to bring a client into the bank. If you'd have told somebody 25 years ago when we were starting out in these industry, what are the two biggest challenges in the export finance industry right now? Leverage ratio and KYC. People have said, what? If you'd have said, funding, credit risk, liquidity even, return on assets, return on equity, any of those things, yes. But those two, no. Completely new challenges for the industry. which the industry will find a way of dealing with, I'm sure. The KYC AML issue is a huge issue for banking generally, not just for export finance. And finding the right balance between getting all of those security issues right, ensuring we're not funding inadvertently terrorism or crime, hugely important. But you've got to do it in a way that doesn't put the brakes on the global economy and stop banks making money and being successful and supporting real business. So, you know, fascinating the way the business has gone as a result of the change.
Yeah, and I mean, I detected sort of a bit earlier that, you know, obviously there is a, to an extent, a trial and error process. You know, there's, you know, something gets out, there's a consultancy, it changes. But Gabby, sort of earlier in the podcast, mentioned sort of two new examples or recent examples of regulation that's come out of the blue that wasn't expected. So the question is, do you think it is going to get better or is it just going to be... And I mean, Gabby, maybe you take that one on.
Yeah, I think it's going to get worse. You know, I think that, you know, we were just talking about, before we started here, about OFAC and Iran and the regulation that's coming out of that. You know, the regulation is a global issue. It's not just a UK-European aspect. And so, therefore, banks who... are looking at this business on a global basis, we'll have to look at all of the regulation across the globe and be cognizant of each of those aspects in terms of the way that does business. And so you only need one country to say, well, you know, our regulators are going to take this more heavier stance, and that has a knock-on effect. So I don't think we're at the end of the regulation or at the top of the regulation peak. I think there'll still be more. It will change eventually. Going back to Simon's, Jones's point, when the economy really starts to bite, but I don't think we are anywhere close to that.
It's going to get worse before it gets better.
Exactly.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's a very challenging period, but it will get better. And that's the important thing, because it has to be practical. It has to work. We can't have a system where either countries or institutions or clients and individuals even are not included in the financial world. You can't have a system which excludes particular geographies or particular high-risk countries.
It'll take time to work our way through it. And the impact was very big because the crisis was very big and there were some big issues and banks fell over. You know, governments had to buy bailout banks. Banks went completely under. So I don't think that there should be any surprise at the level of change and regulation that is being imposed. But it has to be carefully thought through and it has to make sure that it fits in with everything else that makes the world go round.
So you've got a situation where, as you said, at the moment, clients possibly aren't feeling the pinch because there are alternatives available. You've also got a situation where, because of the regulatory pressure on export finance, it's, you know, maybe some of the things that could be done before can't be done or can't be done as easily. Maybe some of the benefits of the product in the past aren't quite the same as they were. And you also have a situation, you know, just with the cost of capital, the availability of capital, where there's a lot more internal competition, I assume, in terms of lending. So how has this all changed the way you've been able to, or you are communicating the export finance product internally?
Good question. Internal communication and positioning within institutions, almost as important as the external side as well. I think in that respect, for export finance, the crisis was a hugely helpful thing because it put export finance centre stage in an environment where previously we'd probably been a little bit peripheral, even in the trade environment. And coming to a situation where suddenly the product is relevant to not just emerging markets, but developed markets, not just triple B borrowers, but single A and double A borrowers as well, was very helpful in terms of increasing the relevance. And that, that's very, very important. Competing internally for resources in big institutions is one of the things we do on a day-to-day basis. Our clients don't see it much, but it's going on behind the scenes. We're competing for equity, balance sheet, RWA, and positioning the product in an effective way to obtain those things is sometimes a very important part of the job. And I'd say we've been lucky in that respect because the last few years have facilitated it. It is a very efficient way of providing liquidity to our clients. It's a very efficient way of supporting clients that want to do real business in a socially useful way. Trade is how certainly Deutsche Bank started in 1870. It was at the request of one of our corporate clients to help finance a railway in Iraq. Funnily enough, last week a request dropped on our desk to finance a railway in Iraq. I mean, what goes around comes around.
Are you doing it, though? That's the question.
And we'll probably do it. I'm pleased to say earlier this year we signed our first new transaction in Iraq, which was very, very pleasing, infrastructure related. So those kind of things, to the extent they're important to our clients, are important to the bank institutionally and therefore important to the management as well.
I think you used the magic word there, which is the one I thought about here, is client. Because what has changed since the crisis is that not everywhere, but 95% the banks involved in export finance are driven by what their clients want rather than driven by the product. Whereas pre-crisis, it was over liquid. Banks had aspirations to be in lots of places in the world. The crisis put pay to a little bit to that. You know, banks were told by their governments and regulators to come back and do what they're good at, not what they want to do. And so I think client-driven focus is the key thing. But if export finance becomes unattractive for banks, they will have to do something about it because of regulation. So they will work around it, maybe, and they will have to become more innovative. But they will certainly only be doing it for their clients, not for anybody that walks in off the street.
And that's key. I think it's about clients. The export credit agency business, the asset itself, 10, 15 years ago, was deemed to be a profitable asset in its own right. Now it's not. Now it's only going to be provided to clients. Part of that is the restriction on balance sheets and deleveraging that's going on. But also part of it is that the banks now are redefining who their clients are. Mm. You know, I look at across the three of us here. We all used to work in large retail banks who had a very global footprint. And we all used to do export credit anywhere around the world, often where there may not be an existing client associated with that trade. But the asset was deemed to be attractive. Now we're competing, as Simon Sayer was saying, we're competing for human resources as well as economic resources. And I think going back to the regulatory aspect, some of the regulation is making this type of asset less attractive to book and hold. Mm. And so therefore it's becoming a scarce resource and it can only be applied to clients.
Under Basel 1 and 2, it was the jam product. It was the cross sell for doing the more difficult stuff with the client, for lending lending the client 3-year revolver money at a very low price was very costly for capital purposes. ECA wasn't under Basel 1 and 2 and was the icing on the cake. That was what we were rewarded with from our clients. Today it's no longer a reward because there are the ability of banks to do it is what the client's looking for, not just giving them something that's deemed to be free.
And I would add also, and this is my own personal view, Gabby Buck personal view, rather than any previous organisation or the BBA aspect. But Simon talked about KYC AML. I think KYC AML are used by existing banks as the barrier to doing new assets onto the book. And the reason I say that, it's a great way of deleveraging or making sure the leveraging ratio doesn't, the leverage aspect of the bank doesn't start to increase by saying to people, if you want to do a piece of business for a particular client or a new client, this is the hoops and hurdles that you have to run through. Fintech companies are still regulated, but they'll go through the KYC and AML aspect in 1-2 days. You know, banks take 2 months. Mm. So they have the same regulators. Their processing, though, is very different. And the reason being, they're hungry for assets. Banks are looking to delever. So I think the regulation is being used internally by banks as a way of dampening down their frontline originators and their staff there.
Yeah, interesting. I'm not sure I completely agree with that. I think the reality is that banks are being asked to police the world's marketplace in terms of trade in particular, and we're being asked to...
And when they get it wrong, they get fined.
And when they get it wrong, they get fined. And that, I think, is a real requirement. It's not something that banks are just doing to help deleverage. But I get the point that deleveraging is happening. Yeah. And the consequence is those, we call them tail-end clients, are falling off the bank's balance sheet and falling off the bank's client list.
And it is a useful way to say no.
Yes.
As Gabby said.
Yeah. And actually, it's a great way to say no, because the bank can never be criticised by external stakeholders, because they can just say, it's not us, it's the regulators. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you said it's credit, then, you know, the outside stakeholders will say, well, you've got to change your credit profile.
Yeah. Well, I think, unfortunately, we are out of time on this issue. Thank you very much for all three of you for broaching a very difficult subject, and one that I'm sure will rumble on, and I'm sure one that we can use for podcasts in the future as well, which is good news. But so everyone, thank you very much.
Keep on the sunny side, always on the sunny side. Keep on the sunny side of life. It will help us every day. It will brighten all our way if we keep on the sunny side.